excuse me, the general topic is change and the church, social change in the church. And what we're trying to do, we looked last time at one major change in our society in terms of the aging of America, the increasing lifespan. You know, sometimes we don't realize how rapidly that has changed. At the turn of the century, a baby born then had a life expectancy of only 44 years. Now, there were obviously people who lived beyond that, but that was the life expectancy. Today, it's above 70 and approaching 75 for females. And some interesting demographical phenomenon occur also. The older you get to be, the older you probably will get to be. Does that make sense? In other words, if you're 70, you have a much better chance of living to 75 than you did when you were 50. So that, as the Lord says, those who have get more, and those who don't have don't get it. Well, we're going to take a broader look tonight at social change, and maybe not talk so much about what the church can do about it. I'd like to reserve that for next week, sort of a teaser to come back, and talk about philosophy, things that are causing our society to change. Maybe you could help me by naming a few things. What do you think some of the greatest changes have been, I guess I'm safe to say, here in the last 25 years? Things that have changed, or in your lifetime?
Our lifestyle, more convenient.
All right.
More convenient.
My heavens, yes, more convenient lifestyle. I have one time I came home and my dear wife said she was so tired, and being not too sympathetic at the moment, I said, which finger hurts? Because we have an automatic dishwasher, we have a self-cleaning oven, we have an automatic washer and an automatic dryer, and we take these things for granted. I remember the first car. My father was the first one in our whole relationship who had a car, a Model T, touring car with isinglass curtains. And to keep your feet warm in the winter, you took a big rock and put it in the oven a while and kept your feet on that. Just about everybody, every man you knew had a broken arm at one time or other, cranking the Ford. And one could go on and on. So that certainly is a social change in that it provides more time to do things. I can recall washing clothes. And we had one of these great big wooden tubs on some kind of a rack, and you had to push it back and forth, and a big paddle went up and down. Copper wash boilers, and the horrible smell of soap in the house on wash day, wading through the kitchen in the winter time. It's the only place you could hang the clothes, and you were ducking around underwear and stuff in the kitchen. On and on. That's a major change. What other changes do you see?
The computer.
All right. So why don't we just broaden that?
Technology.
Just say the whole communication.
Communication.
Certainly has changed. The first radio that I listened to, I'm beginning to sound like I'm 97 years old, was a crystal set, and you had to jiggle around and. Finally, you'd get something. You didn't care what it was. You were so astounded. I remember watching television. Remember visiting the neighbors, the rich neighbors, and watching wrestling, sitting there like stupid idiots in the dark, and the thing was all full of snow, and you were so taken by it. Now we look at these things. We can hear a pin drop in London. Grandma, what big ears you have. We can see a building bombed in Beirut. Grandma, what big eyes you have. And this, too, of course, has affected our culture and our society, sometimes for the better and sometimes for worse. The argument goes on, doesn't it? Is television good? What other changes have you experienced?
Medicine.
And that, of course, accounts to a great extent for the increasing lifespan. We're getting to the point where we expect almost more than medical science can deliver. Now, there was a time when going to the hospital, everybody wept when you went to the hospital because you never came out alive. Very few people did. It was simply a place of last resort. Cancer was automatically a death sentence. I can recall in my early days in the ministry visiting kids in the hospital in iron lungs before we had Salk vaccine. A lot of good things, right? What other things? You might want to think of something negative, not only in terms of scientific invention and whatnot, but what else do you see changing in terms of social relationships?
Moral values. They're moral values.
Oh, sure.
People are more open in everything. When I was young and everything, people didn't have children out of wedlock and feel like as if they had accomplished something and keep the child.
Yeah, so the change in moral values has some pluses. Maybe we've gotten out of some of the phoniness of the Victorian age, as they say, or the New England pietism. But is it all to the good? Sex is out of the closet. In the most polite society, you can say things today that you would have blushed 30 years ago to even mention in polite society. Divorce, of course, the whole institution of marriage has changed. Now, it hasn't changed for everybody, but it has for a great many people. Coming out of the homosexual closet, for instance, that has changed. The kind of language that is permissible on television, even. They're a little more careful. The kind of movies that you see were the kind that you'd sneak through a back alley to see a number of years ago. Now, is this good or bad? Can be argued. There may be some good things. Some people would say, well, at least we're more open. But sometimes I think also we're a little dirtier. So, and the church confronts this kind of thing, especially dealing with young people. Any other changes that you can see? Certainly the community.
Transportation, would that be possible?
Yeah, by heavens, transportation. I can recall we lived in Buffalo and we'd go down to the farm, which was 30 miles away, and we'd prepare for a week. Among other things, you were sure you were going to have at least one flat tire and a broken spring on the way. Last summer, I flew to southern Brazil, and counting stopovers in Atlanta and Miami and Rio de Janeiro, I was there in 18 hours. Had a nice sleep, a good dinner, and you can span the globe. So there are many of these things that affect our civilization, our culture, and our society, who we are. So this is what I'd like to do, is have you think with me a little. But we do need to think about ourselves and our lives. A lot of people are rather heedless, and we call this philosophy. Whether we read technical philosophy or not, we are all philosophers. Philosophy is an attempt to organize and synthesize all of life and being and experience, and from such synthesis derive operable principles, policies, and practices, someone has said. Which means we're trying to figure what's coming down. What is it all about? Here I am. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't make the world. And yet here I am. And by our philosophy, we attempt to justify our judgments and our actions. So we all have to be philosophers. Everybody has at least a philosophy, what life is about. Sometimes we find it very difficult to enunciate it, but it forms our attitudes, and our attitudes determine our action patterns. Marriage, I suppose, is a good example. some people enter marriage. They hold it very lightly. We hear these songs on the radio. There's one which sort of poo-poos the idea that some words on an old piece of paper can bind me to anything. And that's new, and that's an attitude toward a very basic institution of life. And as a result, people react accordingly. We're all in the business of interpreting life. And whether we become someone who wants to be decent, upright, honest, work hard, or whether we want to be we decide it's a lot easier if you can break into people's houses at night when they're not there and steal things. It's a lot easier working, a little riskier, perhaps. What makes a man want to become an astronaut and risk his life being shot off into space? So we have to realize that our attitudes affect what we do. And obviously the church today needs to know what people are thinking, what their needs are in our kind of society. Dealing with young people today is much different from what it used to be. We could always get a bunch of church kids together and have a marshmallow roast, and that was a big deal. And if you were terribly risque, you played spin the bottle and sort of giggled and felt a little guilty about it. It's kind of fun, though. So all of us find that we have a philosophy which establishes our value system. And the church increasingly finds that its value system, as promulgated by the writers of the Bible, is not accepted. And a lot of people don't even know what their value system is. There's a lot of experimentation today, and it's a fairly good devices whereby you can determine what people's value systems are. You read the Sermon on the Mount, and the assumption of so much of Scripture is that we have a very high value system of universal moral judgments. For instance, the value of a human life. But we see around the world, not everybody feels that way. Certainly not even in our own society. We have people in our own communities who have very little value for human life. We learn to try to avoid them, stay out of certain neighborhoods. And the Decker case is in the news again tonight, and we all shudder at that. For heaven's sake, can't you even go Christmas shopping without somebody murdering you? As the church, and I think as parents and as citizens, we have to know something about people's value systems. But where does it all come from? It really comes from philosophies. And there are really only two. I'll tell you about some others. And basically, as you look at life, you have to make up your mind whether you have a secular view of life or a religious view of life, and specifically a Christian view of life. There are those who like to say all religions are the same. They all lead to one place, and they all believe in a God and speak of their higher power and so on. But Christianity holds itself forth as being absolutely unique and exclusive. All men shall honor the Father, even as they honor the Son. He that honoreth not the Son honoreth not the Father who has sent him. We sometimes find our Jewish friends getting a little upset if we attempt to evangelize them, and they say, what's the matter with you people? We've got our own religion. And we've got a lot of Christians who say, that's right, leave them alone. Don't say anything to them. Now, Rabbi Tannenbaum, who's the leader of a major secular Jewish movement in America, his office is in New York, is a personal friend of mine, and Mark and I have had many arguments, pro and con. And he says, you Christians are always bothering us. And I say, Mark, when the day comes that I stop bothering you, you start worrying. Because I believe that you cannot enjoy eternal life without Christ. He has, and I don't know whether he's gotten any closer, he still doesn't accept it, at least openly. So, what are some of the philosophies? It's sort of like a marketplace. We're in it, We're deluged by it every day. We don't recognize it very often as philosophy. Our kids are deluged by it. And this cannot help but have a strong effect upon us. Things have changed. When Harvard University was founded in 1643, which is more than 300 years ago, from the original rules and precepts for Harvard College, this is what they said was the reason for establishing it. Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. And that's a far cry from what would be said today. And to indicate, here are some other quotes which would indicate this concern we have, that though we seem to know more, we have a communication explosion from this deliverous Heavenly Father. We have computers on campus now, and there's hardly a day goes by that I don't get a stack of readouts. Here's all the information. It's about 100 times more than I wanted to know. It's really getting to that point. If you ask a simple question, they drown you in data. But here's what was said in the Christian Century magazine by the editor at that time, Dr. C.C. Morrison. He said, public education without religion creates a secular mentality faster than the church can Christianize it. And this is one of the arguments behind the Christian school movement, which is gaining strength again. Although we have to be very careful that we don't turn our Christian schools into private schools and don't properly carry out their purpose. Or Walter Lippmann, whose name you may remember. Day after day, young people are subjected to a bombardment of naturalism with all of its animosity to Christianity. In the formative years of their lives, or at least during the period of their education when their ideas are crystallizing, they must listen and absorb these ideas of man, the world, and religion. And with these facts before them, why do Protestants wonder that Christianity has so little influence over young people? Because there is a secular, I call it a religion. Or Julian Huxley, who will be quoted on the other side, when he was Director General of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, said this: the advance of natural science, logic, and psychology has brought us to a stage at which God is no longer a useful hypothesis. A faint trace of God still broods over the world like the smile of a cosmic Cheshire cat. Remember from Alice in Wonderland? But the growth of psychological knowledge will rub even that from the universe. Kind of a chilling statement, and yet all too true. So what are some of these philosophies, these ways of looking at the world? And you have to remember that philosophies really deal with a limited number of subjects. For instance, what is reality? Called metaphysics. And you can go all the way back to Plato and Socrates and so on. What is real? And here we'll see a naturalistic, materialistic point of view absolutely at odds with what we preach about, what we hear in church. You know, when you enter the world of the Bible, you are entering a world of a different reality. There are angels on the plains of Bethlehem. There is a personal devil. St. Paul can blithely say, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Jesus can say, I am where I go, you cannot come, but where I go, I also will come again and receive you unto myself. You read all of these marvelous things in Revelation, the great white host before the throne. And even worse, somebody would say, you got axe heads that float, dead people come to life. There's an earthquake on Good Friday. And on and on, we enter a world of the miracle
in a world which is not bound by this earth. Now, the secular humanist will say, well, that's all wishful thinking. That is not real. So we have a naturalism. They go by different names, which means that nature is all the reality there is. Another topic that you study in philosophy, and we all do, informally or formally. If you go to college and study it, you have to read all these guys. What is a human being? And these are disturbing questions, but there are strange answers. One of the most influential men in the public education in America today is Boris F. Skinner. I think he's totally retired. He's well up in years. Professor at Harvard, who maintains that we are nothing more than evolved animals. The only thing that differentiates us from an animal is a more complex nervous system. There is no such thing as a mind. All of these things are called ghosts, conscience, will. All of these go out the window, and he says, I can get you to do anything you want by operant conditioning, simply by giving or withholding rewards. And a lot of our public education is based on that premise, that that's what a human being is. You don't appeal. Skinner, at his worst, says we should do away with all police, all courts, all jails. So we don't need these. They don't work anymore. What we need to do, and people aren't doing what we want them to do, is recondition them. We can condition them as surely as he got pigeons to play ping pong. And there used to be a Missouri Synod Slovak who was the chief trainer over here at the zoo years ago, and I was a student. We used to watch him. He always had his pockets full of food pellets and sugar cubes, and he could get ponies to jump through flaming hoops and all kinds of things. Skinner, and it's sort of the thesis of Orwell's 1984, which I remind you is next year. Big Brother is watching, and Skinner wrote a book, his last book probably, and it has a frightening title, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. He said that when we didn't have so many people in the world, we could afford to pretend that people could do what they want. We can't afford that anymore. We've got 4,500,000,000 people in this world, and it's increasing geometrically, and there are just too many of us. We now have to get people to do what society can endure. You ask him, well, who decides what we should be doing? And he says, well, the psychologist, naturally. they decide. So mind is the point of view of a naturalistic point of view is that there is no, never mind, they say. Now the idealist, and there aren't many of them around, used to say there is no matter. But most people today, almost by nature, I guess, are naturalists. Man is continuous with nature. I just got another book to review today on death and dying. Every time they get one of those, they give it to me. ominous. Anyway, I don't like this one because it picks up a basic theme. Don't be afraid of dying, because dying is the next stage of life. And you owe it to your society and to your world not to complain about it too much. After all, what do you want? Corliss Lamont, who labels himself the spokesman of secular humanism, and honestly, very honestly, says there is no God, all this nonsense. He has one chapter entitled, This Life is All and Enough. Now, most secular humanists are rather well-educated people and pretty good people. They're not out to say, eat, drink, and be merry, and be a slob. But they say, this is the only life you have, and therefore make the most of it, and they will be patrons of the arts, and so on. They say, live decently and learn to enjoy things to the utmost. Or as the beer company would say, you only go around once, so grab for the gusto. You see how subtly a philosophy gets right into our living rooms? That is a philosophy. You only go around once, so grab for the gusto. And here comes Jesus Christ and says, if a man seeks to save his life, he will lose it. And if he loses his life for my sake, he will gain it. He will gain the whole world. Exactly the opposite. So the naturalist would say there is no supernatural. That's a figment of our imagination. The communist said religion is the opiate of the people. Well, it's nice that people go to church and make them behave. It's cheaper than building jails. Besides, the taxes don't have to pay for it. That's why they don't make churches pay taxes. It's the biggest bargain going for the government. If people will learn to behave a little bit by going to church, that's why they have chaplains in the armed forces, to get people to behave. It's a cheap form of control, they think. It's very, naturalism is very deterministic. They have a saying that says, all behavior is lawful. Now that sounds funny. It doesn't mean you can do whatever you want, but it means you and I never decide what to do. Even as I stand here talking to you, I am forced to do it by outward environmental forces. And there's nothing inside me. Gilbert Ryle, from Cambridge University, speaks of the ghost in the machine. I got into a behaviorist classroom and doing my graduate work one time and almost got thrown out. I raised my hands and said, what about mind? Ooh, you'd think I'd uttered a curse word. The prof, who was from Stanford, got terribly angry. Anybody who has a graduate education should know better than to speak of a human mind. Brain, he says, you can talk about. That I can see, measure, and put an electro galvanometer on there and measure the electrical impulses. That's something I can see. So that there are various forms of this that go by various names. They see mind merely as a physiological entity, which is merely a brain, and they're studying that to find out. It's still like to build a computer as efficient as the human brain. Intelligence, or the intellect, is merely a brain function, no different from a muscle function, really. And here, of course, we get into the theory of evolution, which is not as simple as some people would make it. Some of our preachers are too simplistic, I think, in speaking about evolution. They say it's only a theory. Well, a lot of things are only theory. It's a very serious theory. And it attempts to explain the origin of matter and of man, especially man. And not too many evolutionists today are Darwinites. They've moved beyond Darwin. The thing I would maintain is that evolution is not only a theory, it is a religion. It ultimately is supernatural. It is based on faith. Because if you keep saying, and where did that come from, and where did that come from, and where did that come from, all of the explanations for the origin of our universe require something to start with. They speak today, they're sort of back to the Big Bang theory, that millions, zillions, trillions, what's the difference when you get up there? They vary all over the place. There was an asteroid or something in space that blew up, you know, fantastically, millions of miles wide, and some little chunks started spinning around, and one of them cooled and became our Earth, and then they tried to explain the origin of life, one-celled amoeba by the action of ammonia and hydrogen and oxygen, which hasn't been proved, and the amoeba decided to become a little more complex, and finally it became a fish, and then a fish decided to walk on the land, and so on. But it's an attempt to answer the basic question, what is man? They don't say that man came from the monkey, but rather that the primates, the apes and monkeys, have a common ancestor with man. Well, what are we anyway? That's a basic question that philosophy tries to answer. Another question is, how do we know? And that's called the epistemological question. How do we know anything? Here the prevailing philosophy is, it's called logical positivism, from a group of men in Vienna, hence known as the Vienna Circle, who came up with this idea that the only thing that is true is that which is observable by the five human senses. Nothing else. Everything else is a phantasm and imaginary. And therefore, of course, this is science. And it is fitting for a scientist not to dabble with anything that he cannot observe. And that's what the scientific method is. You're always measuring, experimenting, and observing. Why? So that you may predict and then control. And it works pretty well. Now, how in the world did they get the spaceships into the right place at the right time? If they'd been off a few seconds, they'd have missed the moon. And there were some worries, you know, that they weren't all that accurate. But they are, and it works very well. Now, some people would say, well, that's it. That's the only way you can get to know anything. Or are there other ways of knowing?
Excuse me, Dr. Schultz, what was that word you used?
Epistemological.
Epistemology, is that the one?
That's the one, yes.
I think my daughter had a Greek word.
My daughter asked me about that one last night, and I didn't know it. Now you're bringing it up.
It comes from the Greek word epistemē, which means knowledge in Greek, and so we steal.
See, the English language is the greatest robber going. If you know German, they use their own words, little words, to make up big words. For instance, a telephone in German is a Fernsprecher. It means a distant speaker. No, we got to say telos and phoné, which means a distant speaker, but it's Greek. Automobile is Greek. Self-mover. In Germany, a television fans there. A farseer makes more sense. No, we have to say tele and vision. And so there's a lot of Latin, Greek, and French, and everything. English steals all over the place. But epistemology means the theory of how we get to know, what is the process of coming to know. And I think we begin to realize we speak of nonverbal communication. That it is not just words. I teach in this very classroom in the morning a class on confirmation instruction, and I tell these future pastors, now you can't just get the catechism, make the kids memorize it, spout it back to you, and say you've done your job. You have to form a relationship with them. It's one of the blessings of a long confirmation period, 2 or 3 years. You can learn the catechism sooner than that, but it's a marvelous opportunity for a pastor to be able to communicate his concern, his love, to be modeling, and so on. And frequently he can be talking about anything but religion, and still people are coming to know. Do we come to know in ways other than this hard, cold, scientific, statistical way? Let's see, what other problems are we confronted with? Makes us feel kind of small. What did Shakespeare say? Right, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps out in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is a walking shadow. It's a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. It's chilling, isn't it? And a lot of people live their lives. Grab it now. You didn't ask to be born. You don't know when you're going to die. You don't believe there's anything after death. When you die out. And there really isn't that much meaning. So, The primary advocates of that kind of philosophy, which governs the lives of a lot of people. What do I care? You've got a lot of young people who get infected by this. They may not know it. They probably wouldn't recognize the name of Søren Kierkegaard, the gloomy Dane, or the name of some of the other existential writers like Camus, and Jean-Paul Sartre, Martin Heidegger. These are the gurus of this who write the opaque books. I took a course in Heidegger one time, and we had to read a big, thick book called Being and Time. And I started reading, and I read the first page about 10 times. It didn't make any sense. I thought, well, maybe that's because he wrote it in German. So I got the German version. I read that. It didn't make much sense either. Very difficult, opaque. He makes new meanings for his words, and he strings words together with hyphens. But basically, this is what's called existentialism, which has a slogan that being precedes essence. That may not make much sense to you. But what the existentialists are saying is we no longer can buy the fact that you've got a model over here of what a human being should be like. And therefore, in our education, in raising our kids, and in governing our own passions and whatnot, we try to be like that. That's what you're supposed to be like. And you worry about what other people think. The existentialist says, the heck with that. The only thing I know is I exist, and hence the term existentialism. And nobody can tell me what I'm supposed to be like. That's phony, inauthentic, they use words like that, that we're forever trying to pretend to be something. You know, we don't even know who we are. There's the person I am now as I stand here pretending to be a lecturer. With my students, I'm a different person. I go home, and I'm certainly not going to talk to my wife this way. She usually tells me, I have heard that. Shut up. When I deal with my dog, I mean, I'm another person. And then inside, I really wonder at times who I am. We have the existentialist says, just admit, the only thing you know for sure is you exist. And some of the philosophers weren't even sure of that. René Descartes he was a crazy French philosopher. He crawled into an oven one day and said, I got to figure this thing out. And he said, do I exist at all? And finally he discovered he was doubting that he existed. And he said, aha, I am doubting, at least I know that. And doubting is thinking, and I think, therefore I know that I am. Cogito ergo sum, in Latin. That's been used a lot. Well, you can have a lot of fun with these crazy philosophers. But the existentialist is saying something important. I think when properly used, it does call us to quit being phony. It's the way I describe law and gospel. Law, God's law says you can't fool God. You know, you can't fool Mother Nature, bang, crash. The law keeps saying, you can't fool God. And the gospel says, you don't have to. And to me, that's one of the most direct ways of saying what Scripture says about law and gospel. That we think we can get away, we excuse ourselves, we pretend there is no God, and yet God keeps coming back and making us guilty. But the gospel comes and says, no matter how guilty you are, you are forgiven. You don't have to fool me. I can look right to the core of your being. So the existentialist, and negatively, and Camus, who was killed in an auto accident fairly young, and others, Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, who wrote dramas, novels, and whatnot, very gloomy. One of his most famous plays is called La Nausée in French, which means nausea, which... And what he's saying in that whole drama is, just the thought of being alive makes me throw up. He said, there is no meaning in life. And Camus said, there's only one piece of advice I can give you that makes sense. Nothing else does. And that is to commit suicide. And the fact that suicide is growing at alarming proportions among our young people makes us stop to think that the message is getting through. Unfortunately, totally atheistic, there is no good. Kierkegaard was not. He was a Lutheran, and he was kind of sickly, and he had a broken love affair, and he got even gloomier after that. We call him the Gloomy Dane. All he was trying to do, he was yelling at the church. He gets somewhere, then goes a stuffed shirt parading and in Sunday and sitting there and being so, and he says, I know what they do all week. That bunch of hypocrites. And he was calling them to authentic, honest discipleship. He said, if you're going to pretend to worship God, then do it. So he was not an atheist, but existentialism mostly is atheistic. And what it says some pretty good things. It says, nobody else is responsible for your life, and you're not responsible for anybody else's. Then shape up and take responsibility. And he said, I can't judge you. If you decide to become a bank robber, God bless you, do it honestly. And be a good bank robber. And it's just as good as anything else. You see, all, well, you know, if that gets popularized, and if you listen, if you can ever figure out the words to some of the popular songs, this is what's being said. So that you move from this kind of high-level, intellectualized philosophy where it all starts. There are very few people in this world who ever get an original idea. I don't know if I've ever had one. But nevertheless, these are highly intellectual people. And somehow, they devise a philosophy of life. And if we make our own choices, which they say, then we're authentic. Any choice is absurd. Yeah, they sort of get to you. It's absurd that you're sitting here, that you came out in a dark night when you'd probably rather be home watching that Bob Hope special that started at 7 o'clock. Here you are. Well, but if you sat home and watched television, that's absurd too. As Fred Allen said, if we keep watching television, we'll have eyes as big as grapefruit and brains the size of a pea. But it's kind of absurd. In a sense, there is something to that. You look at what you do. Oh, I gotta go to that dumb party. But what if we don't go? Well, you know, the boss is gonna be there. So off we go. And we go buy a tux and feel terribly miserable, and a man who doesn't feel like too much of a sissy puts ruffles down the front. I got some. Feel like an ass when I put them on, but I do it. It's absurd. I finally got a little relaxed on that. Might as well be absurd. But you see, if you come to the conclusion that everything is absurd, nothing makes sense. And therefore, the only thing that you know for sure is you exist, so go at it. If you don't like it, commit suicide. Now, those are some of the things. Then logical positivism, I've mentioned. Materialism, which is another way of saying naturalism, all being is quantitative and material. Man is a highly developed organism. Human awareness is an intricate process of the central nervous system. Awareness, we think we're thinking, we're observing, we're judging, and these people shake their heads. You're not doing anything like that. You got a few little organisms. You are an organism. You got brain cells and your spinal cord. There's no being higher than man. That is the major thesis of secular humanism. Man is the measure of all things, not God. And therefore, since there's so many of us, we have to use some brains and try to figure out a society and a culture that we can live with. We do have to have red lights. Otherwise, we're all going to get smashed up. Nobody likes to stop at a red light. But civilization itself, as Freud said, brings with it its discontents. We'd like to do a lot of things that we simply can't because it would foul up our society. So we impose these things upon us, upon ourselves as people, in order to live together. We can put up with a few mavericks, but for heaven's sake, you can't have a cop at every street corner to see that everybody stops at a red light. You have to assume that most people will. Because, well, why? Because they're afraid to. Why did people send in all that money last Friday? I sure didn't want to, and I sent in a big chunk because I'm considered self-employed and we pay quarterly. Yikes. Well, I guess I'd have to admit I sent it in so I don't get, and I was honest on my return, so I don't get audited and all that kind of stuff. So life is crazy, isn't it? In education, we have some of these philosophical viewpoints expressed. In public education, what in the world are the public schools expected to do? I don't know if I'd want to be a public school educator. I've known enough of them and was in it for a while. Discovered how absolutely frustrating it must be. What in the world do we want? What does the public want? Want us to teach? What is the product? You got some people who say, well, I want the kid to make a lot of money, so give him skills. And so we get into the colleges and we abolish the whole liberal arts program. Who studies Latin anymore? Who studies Greek? The basic humanities used to be the study of the ancient languages and the ancient literature from 5th century B.C. Greece and from Rome. You began by reading Caesar's Gallic Wars and all that. I don't know many high schools that even attempt to teach Latin. Nobody wants to take it anyhow. Even our students today, our pastoral students, hardly any of them have ever studied Latin. They don't study German. We used to have to. I don't know if that was better, but about 4 years out of your training as a pastor was learning to read and speak German to preach it and learning to read Latin and learning to read Greek and learning to read Hebrew, and then if you throw in a little French or Spanish, that was all the better. Well, we had a different viewpoint that was what culture meant, that you could then reach back into the past and find all the confusion that you find there, I guess. They told us then if we read all that stuff, we'd be wise. I'm not sure we are. But the education changes as the success routes change. For instance, in ancient Rome, the success route, the way to get rich and famous, was to be an eloquent public speaker. And so the schools tried to turn every kid into a public speaker. All the kids were putting rocks in their mouth and trying to declaim against the waves. In ancient Greece, if you read Plato, he would say, no, don't do anything practical. Well, he could talk. He was rich. And when you read about the famous democracy of ancient Greece, you remember it was only about 10% of the people that were there. It was built on a slave foundation. And one today also needs to mention, in the next Wednesday, we're going to talk about specific Christian philosophy of life. And if you have a Bible, you might bring it along next week. I'll conclude by indicating that a major thing that influences our lives, of course, is Marxism, known as communism, dialectical materialism. And very few people ever understand it. Sometimes I begin by quoting to my classes the history of all hitherto, and I say, what am I quoting? And they don't know. It's the Communist Manifesto. You know, every day in the paper we read about communism. I have met very few people who even know where to look for the Communist Manifesto or Marx's Das Kapital, and perhaps we ought to be doing some reading. Basically, dialectical materialism of Marx, and I'm not sure whether in Russia, whether under the Soviets, I don't think they're any more Marxist than I am. I don't even think they understand it. They've never made it work, as Marx wrote it. But what they're saying is that the basic fact, the dynamic, the thing that moves human existence is economics. And you control the means of production. And therefore you get this whole thing of statism, class struggle, down with the rich, up with the poor, which isn't working in Soviet Russia. The dictatorship of the proletariat, these are all, and you see signs, they say, in Moscow with all these things on. And that real freedom is a delusion. And they finally come down to that what you need is a powerful state that keeps everybody in order, tells them when to get up, when to go to bed, and so on. And in the process of producing that glorious world of the future under Soviet communism, anything is acceptable. And this is why this whole business of of a nuclear arms contract with the Russians, I think is a futile thing, because they have told us we will lie. And they will say, because we have such a great thing for all the people of the world, it's worth lying. And, you know, it must be a terribly frustrating thing for any president or secretary of state of the United States to deal with the Russians. Because on principle, they will tell you, we will deceive you. Because you're such scum, you're wrong, we know we're right, and therefore we're going to use anything within our power. Makes it frightening, doesn't it, living in the age when, after Harry Truman dropped the egg and scared everybody to death. So that in a time of philosophical and religious pluralism, where do we stand? And what is the basic, what is the Christian view of all of this, of God, of nature, of man, of knowledge, of morals and values, life, death, meaning of life, and so on. Christianity is a philosophy of life, and our Lord presented it that way. It's the same philosophy that you find in the Old Testament. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Do you have any comments or questions? It's been kind of a tour de force of a thumbnail sketch of philosophy. Yes?
There was a man maybe 15, 20 years ago that was from Estonia, and he was under the influence of Soviets.
Yeah.
And he, a young man, he was doing quite a bit of writing, and he would always make reference to that dialectic materialism.
Yeah.
And I never understood it, and I don't know whether I still, after you explained
yeah,
it,
I just, recognized I just the touched name. That. Yeah.
He used to use that quite often in hopes that he would get across to whoever would have an opportunity to read this little paper just how the Russians are, how the Soviets are.
Yeah.
How they
you
are.
Have to realize that, that Marxism, Karl Marx, went to England and did most of his studying in England. At the time of the Industrial Revolution, when the poor laborer was terribly abused, there were no unions. You had, you know, they sent the 10-year-old kids down into the mines for 12, 14 hours and whatnot. So in one sense, dialectical materialism was Marx's philosophical answer to get rid of this. What he's saying by it, that the primary question you ask in any country is who controls the means of production. And they said in that day, and it was true of England, industrial England, that you had the robber barons who were grinding people under because they controlled, they owned the mines, they owned the factories, they owned the tools. And all that the working man had to give was his energy, his time, his life. And they simply took it away. So there were tremendous injustices. And that's why the basic idea now of the dialectic of material, that the only thing there is in life, Soviet communism and Marxism, of course, are atheistic. There is no God, there's no afterlife, there's no soul. That's the materialism of it. The only thing that counts is money. And the what really makes the world go round is who is in control, who owns the mines. So you take it away from all the rich, the bourgeois. You kill all of them. They're hopeless anyhow. And the common man then can get a decent wage because now he owns the factories. The catch with that in Soviet Russia is they've never gotten to that point. They still talk, eventually we will get to that, but we can't trust the common man, so who runs it? The Soviet Party. And but their basic philosophy is revolved all around labor unions, factories, production, and so on. And those are the only ultimate values. And that's the materialism of it. And the dialectic is that throughout history you've had changes in who controls it. You had slavery, now you get rid of slavery, but what replaced it? The downtrodden, non-unionized worker. This in turn creates the need for unionizing. But unions go too far. And now you'll get something else. Now you get the state taking over. That's the dialectic, which always moves from a thesis to an antithesis to a synthesis. And that's the term. all over?
Yes.
Okay.